This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for being here. I'm here with Phyllis Nash. She's head of screenwriting at UCLA. I want to give a shout out to Amy Villarejo, who's the chair of film and media at UCLA. I spoke with her about the series on Panic, and I told her how much I wanted to talk about this particular film, and she said, well, I have the person for you. So thank you, Amy, and thank you, Phyllis, for being here today. So let me start. You met Patricia Highsmith in 1987 when you were working at the New York Times. Can you tell us more about your friendship with her? Although I understand you can't talk in depth about the limited series you're now working on, maybe you could tell us just a bit to why you were drawn to telling a story about Highsmith.
Sure. I think first, though, I'm going to give you all a little lesson on strangulation. I met Pat in 1987, a few days before Halloween, as it turns out. And I think the story of how we met says just about everything about what our friendship was like. Through the last more or less decade of her life, I was a researcher at the New York Times. I was working on a magazine that they then published called World of New York. And the editors wanted to do a walking tour of Greenwood Cemetery, which is in Brooklyn, and which is the final resting place of numerous luminaries and gangsters and assorted dancers and showgirls. And so they had asked Ruth Rendell if she wanted to do it, and she wasn't available. So they're rooting around for someone, and I, of course, had read the Ripley novels at that point, and my personal favorite novel of Pat's, which is Deep Water. And I said, well, what about Pat Highsmith? I think she's in New York doing a book tour. It was for Found in the Street. And they called her and she said, yes. And so they said to me, well, why don't you go with her to the cemetery? It's your idea. So I was dispatched on a stormy morning in this big limo to pick up this woman who was staying at a seedy hotel in Gramercy Park. And I'm looking around and I thought, who would she be? I was to meet her in the lobby, and I saw in the corner this hunched over figure in a dirty raincoat, the largest feet and hands I'd ever seen. And this was Pat Highsmith. She was smoking, which is when smoking was still allowed indoors. And I said, hello, are you Miss Highsmith? It's this stupid, chirpy little researcher. And she looked at me. She looked me up and down. And she went, I said, okay, well, this way. And we went into this limo, and it was raining. And she was on one side of it, a stretch limo, and I was all the way on the other side. And it was silence. And the only thing she had any interest in were the garbage trucks that were going by, oozing, you know, Soylent Green or something. And at a certain point, this is a long ride, traffic in New York, she turns to me out of nowhere and she said, they tell me you want to be a writer, a playwright. Is that true? And I said, oh, well, yes, but I haven't written anything yet. Ha, ha, ha. She turns away. 10 minutes go by. She turns back. She said, what do you think of Eugene O'Neill? And I didn't think much of Eugene O'Neill and wasn't sure I should say that. But I ended up saying, not much. And she said, good. Turns away, looks out the window again 10 minutes later. And what about Tennessee Williams? So I said, well, I have some time. I have a lot of time for him. Good. It's this way. We're pulling up to the cemetery. And she said, one more thing. what about this Sam Shepard? So I said, oh yeah, I like him. And she said, I saw, what was it? What's the name of the Shepard play in which the brother and sister are in the hotel room? Incest, all that. And she said, I saw this play last night. I saw his play, Sexually Quite Depraved. And it was admiring, you know.
Yeah.
So I said, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So we go on a tour of the cemetery. She has a cane with her. She's poking and prodding graves and doesn't say much, grunts. And we get to the grave, one grave, and she gets very animated. It's the grave of Lola Montez. So she said, oh yeah, she was wonderful, wasn't she? It's like, I don't know. Yeah, I guess. We go into the crematorium. We have this hideous tour where we're asked to put our hands inside the just, still warm, you know, lovin'. And then it's over. We're outside. And she takes this flask out of her Mac. And it's about 11 a.m. now. And she opens it, she drinks it. And she said, I don't know about you, but I need a drink here. God knows it could have been poison. But I had to take it. And it was scotch, which was one of her preferred drinks. And she was quite, yeah, okay. And invited me for lunch, which consisted of cans of Rheingold beer. And that pretty much was my relationship with Pat Highsmith. She would show up in New York. Later, when I moved to London, I saw her a lot more often. But as I began to write, she began to have more time for me, and was quite a generous and supportive, I can't call her a mentor. I don't think Pat was anyone's mentor, but she didn't think I was an idiot. Let's put it that way.
It's always a plus.
It's a plus.
Well, let's turn to the film we've just watched. I understand that once Hitchcock secured the rights to the novel, he shopped around for a screenwriter. He was turned down by 8 or maybe more writers, including John Steinbeck and Raymond Chandler, each of whom thought the story was too tawdry. What more can you tell us about adapting the novel to the screen? You've said to me in just an exchange of email that a trio of women slaved over the script at the end and that Pat Highsmith was angry with Hitchcock's adaptation. So what can you tell us about that?
Well, she was, first of all, most angry because he had paid very little for it, and Pat was very interested in money. So he did what he always did, which is he bought it blind in a trust or something. It wasn't in his name. So it was bought for the equivalent of about, it was bought for $7,500, which now is probably going to be around, it was $75,000 in 2016, so you can figure it out. That was nothing when you consider what popular books, but he bought it while it was unpublished.
Yeah.
He was smart. And he had a man named Whitfield Cook write what they called then a treatment, what we probably now call a detailed outline. So it was quite a substantial document. And Whitfield Cook he met through his daughter, Patricia, who plays the best role in the movie, Babs. And Babs was an actress who did a Whitfield Cook play on Broadway, and that's how Hitchcock met him and quickly enlisted him. So he did the story for, I think it was Stage Fright, and then this. Now, Whitfield Cook, who pursued Hitchcock's wife romantically, it's another story for another day, also was a little bit, maybe he was bisexual. And so Hitchcock drafted him knowing what he might bring to the adaptation of the story. But Hitchcock being Hitchcock dictated a lot of the story. So with this adaptation, he went out to get a named writer because Hitchcock was also a bit of a snob, right? And he thought, well, they'll do it if I get someone. So there was Steinbeck, there was Dash Hammett, Chandler, a few others. And then he hit upon Ben Hecht, who said, I can't do it, but I have an assistant, Chenzi Ormond, who is a woman. I don't know if he told Hitchcock that, but as it turns out, she is the quintessential Hitchcock blonde, basically, Chenzi Ormond. So Hitchcock was like, okay,
yeah, I think
sure,
she'll work.
Fine. So Chenzi Ormond, Alma Revel, mm-hmm, right? And the a woman who gets credit as a production assistant, I think mm-hmm, it's Barbara Kahan, sat and wrote the script. Raymond Chandler wrote a couple of drafts early on. Hitchcock hated them. In fact, I don't know if it's apocryphal, but there's a story about him meeting Chenzi Ormond, giving her the script, holding up Chandler's script and holding his nose, and saying, yeah, no, not one word, nothing. So this is totally new off of Whitfield Cook's scenario. And over the last 3 weeks, most of what you see on screen was written by that trio of women. Only Chenzi Ormond is credited. Chandler got a credit not because he wrote a single word, but because the studio wanted his name on it. And it's one of the things that led the Writers Guild to come up with their arbitration process early on.
Well, interesting.
Yeah. So that's the story of that. Alma Revel was obviously quite instrumental in all of his movies, but his daughter got him his, scenarist, and the rest is Hitchcock ordering women around, as, you know, was his wont, right?
Well, Patricia Highsmith wrote this when she was 29. And it, you know, in 1950, I was surprised when you said, you know, she wanted money, and I think, yeah, you know, but it was her first novel. But of course, his adaptation deviates in significant ways from her novel, which...
Yeah, she hated it. Yeah.
Adaptation.
She hated the movie.
Yeah.
She didn't hate all of it.
Well, what did she hate and what did she like?
Well, you know, the lack of exchange of murders, for one thing. That's pretty...
That's right, because one of the main changes from the novel is that in Highsmith's version, the characters are drawn into each other and they merge. In Hitchcock's version, there's a kind of good and evil playing out and, you know, good reestablished at the end and so on.
So Guy and Bruno do, in fact, trade murders, and it's a meditation and rumination on guilt and what drives confession and all sorts of things. So she didn't like that. She really loved Robert Walker. She loved Bruno.
I mean, he's so wonderful.
But she was infuriated by Ruth Roman, who plays Anne. When I watched it today, I was envisioning in every single scene Hitchcock's choice for that role, who is Grace Kelly. Mm-hmm. And she was not Grace Kelly at the time, necessarily. So the studio wanted Ruth Roman.
Wow, there was a moment when I was watching it today and looking at Ruth Roman, and she had this expression on her face that just recalled Judy from Vertigo. I thought, you know, maybe the same kind of repulsion or something, but the same visage.
But she has absolutely no sense of humor. So can you imagine Grace Kelly doing some of that?
Yeah.
It would have been quite a different thing, but equally compelling.
So what did she loved the actor, she loved...
She loved the actor, she loved... some of the visual choices. She did understand why one would change Guy Haines from an architect to a tennis player, but she did not understand the Washington stuff, which I know that
I was going to ask you later, but I'll ask you now since it's come up. So what did she understand about the change? Why did she think it would be more visually interesting? It would create suspense?
Yeah. She thought, well, you know, who's going to sit around watching somebody do a sketch,
right?
Or talk about building a white bridge, or any of those things that's in the novel. For those of you who have read the novel, she was very interested in Texas. Pat was born in Texas, so she didn't like the.
Where is Metcalf supposed to be in this film?
It's got to be between Washington and New York.
Whereas Metcalf in the novel is in Texas. So I think that's a significant change.
It is significant. But of course, in the novel, the events play out over at least 6 months.
Yeah.
At least. And this seems like the end of the tennis season because they're at Forest Hills. And I think it felt like a couple of weeks, maybe.
Yeah, maybe three, but not more.
And she loved Bruno's mom.
Well, who doesn't?
Aunt Clara.
Yeah. Is that Aunt Clara?
Yeah.
As you were saying, the other significant change is the setting, as you were bringing up. So we're not in Texas. And the film translates the action really from New York and Connecticut to Washington, D.C. And Washington, D.C. figures very prominently in the film. So what's your view about why this decision on Hitchcock's part to set this against the U.S. Capitol?
I think that was Whitfield Cook. I mean, that what he brought to this was his long career as a lefty activist, right? And his contributions were all like that. He softened Bruno, too. In the novel, Bruno is an out-and-out alcoholic, drunk. I mean, he's in the end of the novel also, he dies differently, which we can get to later. But he brought that to the scenario. And the women brought all of the things you remember. The cigarette lighter, the tunnel of love, the merry-go-round climax, which is stolen from Edmund Crispin's novel, The Magic Toy Shop. Mm-hmm. But they brought that, and he brought the political grounding. And also I think he was probably more interested in the homosexual panic of it all, because in looking at the dates, McCarthy, it came later. And so there was rumblings of committees and all of that, but it was really the early homosexual panic that he was.
Yeah, and infiltration into the nation's capital and so on and so forth.
Bruno on those steps.
Very menacing, very much, following him wherever he goes. Yeah, well, there's in scholarship, in film scholarship, there's at least one author who talks about it as precisely a choice to talk about, so that the setting is a character in itself for the film, and that it's all about this kind of menace that is this, as you said, it's more heterosexual panic and a gay menace that somehow has to be expelled at the end of the film. So he does a big analysis of it in that way. But I guess one of the things I was thinking about back to the characters is, all right, you've just said that, you understood, and Pat Highsmith understood, that Guy had to be, why the switch was made to be a tennis player from an architect, and what was more interesting to watch, and so on. But could we talk about the class dynamics in the film? I mean, on the one hand, it's not just between Guy and his promiscuous wife, Miriam, who is, seems to be this kind of working class woman from somewhere we don't know. And Ann Morton, who's the daughter of the U.S. Senator, Bruno, who's this wealthy psychopath. There's that moment, for instance, when Barbara says, Guy says to, Bruno says to Guy, after he meets Ann, he says, quite an upgrade, And it struck me that is it an upgrade in a class sense? Like, he's moved up the social ladder. Certainly he's going to move from his amateur status into working in politics. But then, Barbara is also Anne's sister. So is it a class thing? What's going on?
Well, I was thinking about this since we were corresponding about it. And it's a very different class dynamic in the novel, first of all. And though Pat Highsmith herself was no champion of women, let's call it that, even though she loves them, her interest in the idealization of women was sexual, whereas you look at Hitchcock, who doesn't come from this country. And remember, in 1948-ish, he was still relatively new to this culture. He's bringing an outsider's perspective and idealized and simplified view of class structure from Britain, where it's much different, right? So he sees politics as power, all of that. Women in his film, except for Babs, and of course that's his daughter, so fair enough. He gives her, you know, the best part. But they are absolutely atrocious. Like, isn't it Babs who calls Miriam, what does she call her? A tramp?
Tramp, or she's a tramp.
She's a tramp. Anne's a pill, who is very, very, there's a puritanical edge to her, which I can only imagine Hitchcock enhanced once he realized he had a stiff actor, right, I guess. I mean, yeah, he works with what he had. But it's also his view of women, which you can run through the film. So I think his idea of class in America in a major way begins a little earlier. But then if you carry on through what's Lifeboat with Tallulah Bankhead, you see the links between how his idea of class and women and how men, it's interesting, Guy is he's almost like a chancer. He's like a cad. He's glomming on to Anne in this movie. If you really think about it, he's an amateur tennis player who says, oh, I don't need anything because, you know, I'm going into politics. And how is he going into politics? With her money. Whereas it's a different situation. In the novel, he works. He takes a job. They get married. It's different. So it's not Pat's view of class, is it? It's Hitchcock. Yeah. And I think he's more interested in sexual dynamics between, well, heterosexual men and women.
Yeah, it just struck me because I think initially I thought when he says, you know, quite an upgrade, I thought, well, you know, it was a class upgrade that, you know, he ditched the working class woman and got the, you know, the very wealthy, stiff upper class woman. But then when it's the, you know, the kind of doubling of Barbara and Miriam.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about that and his more general view. You're already moving in that direction towards his view of women throughout this film. In a course I'm teaching right now on the theme of panic, I picked several Hitchcock films and I picked them specifically because the Hitchcock blonde kind of figures from Blackmail to Notorious to Psycho and The Birds. But I'm wondering how you see something like Strangers on a Train in his larger corpus of work.
Well, Strangers on a Train it's got the most dry wit of any of this early period, right? Early-ish to middle period. Once you get into even Rear Window, which was only a couple of years later, right? He's so completely invested in and besotted with, you know, his blonde.
Yes.
Which he didn't have here.
Yes.
I think it freed him in some peculiar way as an artist not to have that object of profound obsession. And instead, what he did is he took it out on the brunettes. So he made the actress who plays Miriam wear those thick prescription glasses. She couldn't see a thing. Mm. She had to be carried around the set. He was taking it out on them. Now, what's interesting in the novel, you've got a bunch of redheads. Mm. Now, this was finished while she was in residence at Yaddo, and while she was experimenting herself with being heterosexual. And she was engaged to a red-headed British novelist whom she despised. So you can see in the novel what the redhead. The redhead is Miriam, who is keeping Guy from his destiny to be with, you know, some woman, other woman, Anne. And Bruno is a blonde. Which is interesting.
Yeah.
Pat had a thing about blondes too. So Hitchcock completely, I could see why he wanted to explore this dynamic, but he didn't have a blonde or a redhead. Oh, actually, Aunt Clara might be a redhead, but you know, he's certainly not interested in her. So yeah, it's an interesting thing to watch him, to watch the way he.
It is, because it is, yeah. It is different.
Yeah.
Although we could compare it to Rope, or we could compare it to.
Oh, Rope, well, you know, what's his name?
Farley Granger.
Yeah. Who is kind of a stiff himself, right? Mm. Handsome.
But a stiff.
But his men often are.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, this time, just
well, the good,
watching.
The good men.
You know, yeah. Watching Notorious and Cary Grant play kind of against type and knocks her out with one punch, you know, it's like, Cary, I didn't know you from this. I wanted to talk a little bit, when I was reading, again, this morning, I was reading over things and reading different critics talk about the novel versus the film, and that, you know, that the film is all about doubles and plays and doubles and doubling, you know, double drinks, double murders, double sets of tennis, just to name a few of those. One critic has written, and I quote, "Of all this doubling, which has no precedent in the novel, was quite deliberately added by Hitchcock and is a key element of the film's structure," end quote. So what's your view here? I mean, you suggested to me that Highsmith was long interested in questions of duality. So,
yeah, and I'm trying to find something. Mm. I jotted down bits of the novel. I think that's not true. I think it's way more subtle in the novel than it is in the film. But here is a little. This is a quote from Bruno towards the end of the novel. He's talking to Anne. They meet a lot, and Anne has a lot to do in the novel that she doesn't hear. "I was thinking of what Guy always says about the doubleness of everything.
That's right.
You know, the positive and negative side by side, every decision has a reason against it. There's a person exactly the opposite of you, and so on. The end of the book, in fact, there's a character that doesn't appear in the film, Miriam's fiancé, Owen, he's called. And it's to Owen that Guy confesses his murder. Now, at the beginning of the novel, he's on the train with a stranger, and at the end of the novel, he is with the opposite, his double, that comes from within himself, as he says. So I think that's not true. I think it's a profoundly Dostoevskian, or whatever you say, however you say that.
That was good. I thought that was very persuasive.
She was obsessed with Dostoevsky and mirrors, and there's a lot of that imagery in the novel that isn't needed in the film because he has other ways to do that. But even he has a mirror in the eyeglasses.
Yes.
A dark one.
Well, I think part of what I... In reading around the novel and adaptation, what you get a lot of is that, you know, Highsmith is humorless, that she's... I'm just saying that these are these mostly and often male critics, you know, saying that she, you know, doesn't, you know, rise to the level of the master.
No.
We've heard that before. Well, let's talk about the particularly cinematic moments in this film. The cigarette lighter, which you mentioned, A to G, the pair of thick lens glasses that reveal a murder. I mean, that scene is, you know, really incredible. And not to mention the wildly spinning carousel at the end. How do these moments enhance? Yeah, I mean, I was saying to students, you know, we're talking about panic, not just as a theme, but panic as it's created aesthetically, formally, in the film itself. And I think These three kind of objects are, like, you know, symbolically laden, hugely laden objects in the film.
Yeah, the cigarette lighter, all of those elements were added by the women, of course. And some of it cribbed without credit from the Magic Toy Shop, but never mind. What was made of it was
great,
stupendous.
Yeah.
He, I mean, Hitchcock, that lighter, that was, you know how that came about?
No, in film.
Oh, okay. It was about product placement. It was one of the early examples of it. Whatever manufacturer there, Ronson probably, went to the line producer equivalent and said, gee, there's a lighter in the book, of course, but doesn't play this part. And said, gee, we'd love to be in one of his movies. And so Hitchcock, you know, always good with the money, said, sure. Went to his wife and his PA and Chenzi Ormond and said, what can we do with that? Wow. And look what they came up with. So that was that. The eyeglasses. Oh, and speaking of the lighter, you know the cross-cutting between the tennis match and the... They came up with that too. But Hitchcock personally chose every bit of debris in that, in the sewer. Every bit of it. He was that kind of guy. But you know, the leaves and the placement and the orange peels and the lighter just where it was. And the glasses, you know, that shot is so complicated. It's double printed. And part of it was done on location where, or wherever they shot the actual actors. And then the other bit was in a studio with the huge concave lens.
Yeah, wow.
And he asked the actress to come in and sort of do this sort of backward thing, like she was doing the limbo or something. And that's how that was put together.
Wow.
And the carousel, well, I wasn't watching it now, but I watched it last week. And yeah, you can sort of see this. He had a miniature built, and he blew that up. And he inserted those shots of horse limbs or whatever the hell was flying around onto the close-ups. Mostly that scene is close-ups. And yeah, that poor guy crawling under.
Underneath.
He's a real operator of a of a carousel. It's undercranked, the shot, but still, if that guy had, he was really doing it, and that was really spinning around, if he had just, you know, that would have been a...
It's just that wonderful moment.
Exactly.
He says, I can do it, I'll go there, and the one of the cops or whatever, mm-hmm, observer says, are you sure you want to do that? And the guy says, well, are you going to do it? Well, I guess you're... No.
But those things...
I think he can do it.
Happen all by accident.
Yeah. Well, I think we can open up now for audience questions.
Thank you for the great discussion. The film pays a lot of attention to the costuming of the characters, especially with the opening sequence with the shoes. But one image that really struck me was Bruno's necktie when they first meet. And I was wondering if that's a detail from the book, specifically it has lobsters on it. I was wondering, if that's something in the book or Hitchcock added that, perhaps.
Hitchcock designed it, the lobster claw tie. It's not in the book, but that was all Hitchcock. Yeah.
I kept looking at the film and looking at the women, especially the Anne character, and this, you know, this clothing that she's wearing, very, very, you know, thin and almost, you know, really perfect, but very, almost, she's always wearing these very light fabrics and ties and kind of see-through, nearly see-through materials, and all the way that they're dressed. You just, you know, this is 1951, but you get the sense of people with very, at least, you know, certainly the senator's office, very well-dressed, very expensive fabrics, this other kind of world, as opposed to Miriam's world and leaving her mother's house. And I kept thinking, when I'm watching it tonight, like, why is there construction going on outside the house? You know, so she doesn't have some clear way out. Anyways, I think costuming is really interesting in the film.
And Pat, in the novel, she pays real attention to Guy and Bruno, what they're wearing all the time, and making distinctions that are Bruno's vulgar, as opposed to Guy, who wears old flannel and just carries himself like some deranged old Yankee with money, you know.
Thanks for a great talk. And at the film's end, there's the juxtaposition or doubling of the Man of the Cross with Sport Magazine. Would you comment on that? And who makes the move to get out of there? Anne or Guy? Or both together?
I don't know. What do you think?
I read that there were three different endings to the film.
Yeah.
Depending where it was released. So there was one with the clergy, and you know, and it is, I kept thinking too at the beginning, right, part of Bruno, it's all about celebrity, he's read about him in the social pages, you know, so he's a mark because he knows his whole story. And so at the end, of course, it's like, you know, whatever, everybody gets scared by a priest or something, you know.
Yeah.
But it was more like, you know, no more, even if they look like there's somebody that we could be trusted. Yeah. You can't even trust the professor from, where did he?
From Delaware.
Delaware State. Delaware State that doesn't rank, you know.
Harvard? Yeah. And I think Hitchcock, my theory about this is that he was so obsessed with the shot before, the scene before, where Anne picks up the phone and Guy, and he wanted, because the camera technology wasn't sophisticated enough, the depth of field wasn't sophisticated enough, he had this huge phone built in the foreground. And when she goes over, it cuts to her, and she's picking up a real phone. But he was so distracted by that, I think, that he just like, oh God, he wanted it to end there.
Yeah, and it did apparently in some releases in the UK.
Yeah.
As opposed to the US that had the more, that.
What would you call it? The more moral something?
Well, the moral of the story is don't talk to strangers on
a
train.
Right, exactly.
Even if they look, you know, respectable.
He was rather rude, right? At the end, he was rude.
Hello, thank you so much for a great discussion and enlightening us really about Patricia Highsmith not loving the adaptation, because I feel, especially with the ending, it does feel almost very moral, very good, very almost like pro-government-like in the sense that it doesn't follow a like typical noir approach of having like a sad ending or a harsh ending. So I guess my question to you is, do you feel like with the changes that Hitchcock made from the novel, do you think Patricia Highsmith, if it was up to her, would choose a different filmmaker to adapt it? And what that filmmaker would be?
Interesting. I can tell you she didn't much like filmmakers.
from what you've told us.
She did like, there was one that she spoke of admiringly to me, and that was Claude Chabrol, and that makes sense, actually, to me, at least. You know, I had read Ripley, right, when I met her, and she asked me when I met her what she thought, well, not that day, but soon thereafter, what did I think of Strangers on a Train? And I just said, oh, I love the movie, you know, blah, 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 blah. And she was appalled.
Man, wrong answer.
So
many of them right, though.
Yeah, well, yeah. Read the book. And then, actually, as I was saying to Patrice, I reread it recently again, and the last moments of that book are so dark, so deep. Guy giving himself over to a detective who's also not in the movie. And the detective is closing in, and Guy just says, take me. Which is a perfect way to envelop us in every single sexual subtext and guilt subtext. So yeah, I think I would have been pissed too. And especially since she didn't make any money off the movie. So I think if it had been a huge hit and she'd made millions of dollars, she would have looked the other way. Yeah.
Thank you for all your comments. It was my impression that the Ruth Roman character had very little dialogue, and I'm wondering if that was just a false perception or something consistent with how the film was to play out. She did a lot of lip chewing and, you know, averting her eyes and fretting, whereas the Hitchcock's daughter had much more dialogue. She was much more instrumental in seeming moving the narrative forward. So I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, what I can say as someone who's dealt sometimes with actors who are not what you might want them to be, I'm sure he cut out a lot of her dialogue and gave more screen time to the more compelling screen presence, who was the daughter, his daughter, and Bruno.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure Guy Haines had more to do too. It has that feel to me sometimes.
Yeah.
But Bruno gets all the speeches, and the daughter gets all of the funny, real funny lines.
Yeah. Well, thank you everyone for joining me. Please join me in thanking Phyllis Nash for joining us here today.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at UCTV.tv.